journalism has always been biased. Mm.
Everything that you read has some kind of socio-political agenda.
You really can't really trust the mainstream media because there's always a hidden bias to it or hidden agenda.
There needs to be a story behind it. There needs to be a narrative behind it, and that's what sells.
This idea that there's some kind of objective truth out there that we're all going to just report.
If you don't have an opinion, one will be given to you.
The world's changed big time, right?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the first episode that we're recording in 2024 of the Unreasonable Podcast, starring none other than Vishal Harnal, 500 Global, and his Hienness.
Oh. Have you given yourself a name?
That's my name, and we'll find out how I got the name.
You call yourself his Hienness?
Yeah. Open Space Excellent. Ventures. But the star of the show today, we captured live in person. Just an amazing person, Tom Wright. Tom Wright, welcome to the show.
Hello, nice to be here.
Thanks for coming on, Tom.
For the viewers, we're going to give you a quick rundown of who Tom is. Investigative journalist, I didn't know, almost Pulitzer finalist, yeah? Wall Street Journal's Asia economics editor, started your career in Jakarta, was one of the first journalists to arrive at the scene of the raid where Navy SEALs killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. And then in 2013, you moved to Hong Kong to start your role as Asia economics editor. And that's when you stumbled across the big story, which you are quite infamous for, and the book, which you co-authored, Billion Dollar Whale. And now you're in your third act, which is to have this thing called Project Brazen. So welcome to the pod.
I know Hien has a number of questions for you relating to what you're doing today, but I do have to ask a couple of questions about Billion Dollar Whale because...
Oh, you're going to go straight
it was,
in.
It was such a captivating book. So I know you're going to ask Tom a lot about his history and what he's going to be doing moving forward or what he's doing right now. One of the questions I want to ask and perhaps start with is, of all of the rabbit holes you could have gone down, why did you decide to pick, or what made you pick the one MDB one and the story on Jolo?
Well, you know what they say about journalism is it's feast or famine, right? You refer to me as an investigative journalist. I never refer to myself as that because, you know, you always want to be on a big story, but sometimes you're not. Mm. And actually, around the time when Billion Dollar Whale, when the one MDB scandal in Malaysia was breaking, I was like trying to find something to do. I was in one of those famine parts of the feast or famine of journalism. And it's always like that. I'm sure VC world is also like that, right? You have big deals, you have fallow periods. There'd been this breaking story because the Sarawak report and the Edge in Malaysia had already actually reported on elements of Jolo and this character. And often foreign correspondents, that's what you do, to be honest, right? You kind of look around, you're covering like so many places. And you look around and think, that looks interesting. This local paper's covered it. And then you go and cover it as well. The stories were just obviously just the tip of the iceberg, that these first stories about Jolo, because they didn't really explain who he was or how he'd stolen hundreds of millions of dollars and how did it connect to the prime minister. So I just got up to Kuala Lumpur and started to dig. And, you know, started with walking around the Shangri-La in my hotel robe, not really knowing how I was going to start to dig, because it's difficult to know where to start.
Is the hotel robe part of the investigative journalist thing that you look slightly...
No, it's just actually what happened. I remember thinking, I remember being in my hotel robe thinking, how the hell am I going to make any progress on this story? Talking to my editor back in Hong Kong.
Yes.
So, you know, and then you chip away. Again, it's probably like your business. You're better to be, if you're not in the game, you're not making any progress. You have to do small things to get big things.
What was the sign that gave away that there's something big here?
Well, like I said, we didn't break the first story. So, so the fact that clearly Jolo, this weird character, was stealing money out of a sovereign wealth fund.
Yes.
That was broken by The Edge and by the Sarawak report.
Yes.
But then so much was not clear about how or what or why. You know, I mean, this was 2015, right? And the book didn't come out until 2018. And the book's 400 pages, including Hollywood stars and photographs of the White House with Obama Goldman Sachs senior bankers and all of that goes into the book. So what we did, you know, just very long story short, at the very beginning, we decided to focus on a charity that Najib was using to steal money. And he was pretending it was one of these yayasan you have in Malaysia. We were able to show that they'd done a bunch of dodgy things. And we put that on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And at that moment, somebody was trying to leak the former Prime Minister Najib's bank accounts that had these hundreds of millions of dollars in them. So we got a lucky break. And to get the lucky break, you've got to have that front page story that puts you in the game and then has something.
That's almost like the bat signal to people that if you want to give more information, clearly the Wall Street Journal is interested
like,
in it.
It's like the in the aristocratic houses in Britain, when you're pheasant shooting, people have to go and beat the bushes to make the pheasants fly. It's like that, right? We had to publish something to be seen as people who were like in it, and then we got this leak, and that's often how it works.
Just email leak@wallstreetjournal.com. Is that how you do it?
Somebody got in touch with us.
Oh my goodness.
All of these folks have Proton Mail.
How do I get in touch with you? I'm like, hi, Wall Street Journal.
Slightly predates Signal and Telegram, I think. So I can't remember. Did it? Did you have Telegram and Signal
in 2015?
I think there was you had those anonymous email addresses, or some of the publications would have drop addresses.
We did have that. Yes.
So you had a drop address. Right?
Yeah. So that wasn't how it was done. It was handed over in a hairdresser's in Knightsbridge. Kensington.
That is.
And until today, nobody knows apart from me.
Michelle's so excited. See, I told you you're going to like this guy.
I mean, it was a riveting read.
Yeah.
There's so much ground that was covered in that book, but perhaps more personally, it was a page turner, but what surprised you the most?
I thought you were going to say, more personally, I was in all the parties with Jola. No.
I wanted to be at one of those Wolf of Wall Street.
Who wouldn't? They would be amazing. Yeah, you know. They would be amazing. What surprised me the most? The level of how things you think sound stranger than fiction are actually true and happen.
You can make this stuff up.
Yeah, it's a cliche, but we use this for Project Brazen, my company now, which we create true stories for adaptation for TV and film.
Yes.
And we use this strap line, truth is stranger than fiction. And it's a slightly cliche thing, but it's amazing how often. So for example, after Jolo was outed by everybody.
Yes.
And we heard, he's having a party in Bangkok. He's got international arrest warrants for him. And he's having this party in this hotel on the Chao Phraya River in Bangkok.
Okay.
One of the other ones downriver. And Nicole Scherzinger is going to be there. And Swizz Beatz, who's Alicia Keys' husband.
Swizz Beatz.
And they're all going to be at this party. And we had a source inside the party, somebody who was attending. And they all turned up for money. At a time when he had two international arrest warrants out for him.
Nicole Scherzinger and Swizz Beatz don't read the Wall Street Journal,
If you were being nice to them, you would say they weren't aware.
Yeah.
But I would say they were also
getting paid. You gotta know. Fantastic.
So Tom, that's the question, right? After all these years being a journalist, right, having the backing of, big publications like Wall Street Journal. And I remember talking to you about this. You said, look, I think mainstream media is dead. And you truly believe that, So maybe you can unpack that.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I'd say it was dead. There's still obviously great newspapers like the Wall Street Journal, my former employer, New York Times, Washington Post, lots of these newer things like Puck, Semaphore, that are doing great work and still uncovering stories and breaking stories. I think the problem is that, for so long, the model was there'd be a big family. Like the Journal used to be owned by this family called the Bancrofts, right?
Mm. Yes.
And then Rupert Murdoch took it over 2006, 2007. And it was cross-subsidized. So the money he was making on TV in Australia, subscription TV in Australia, was cross-subsidizing a lot of the investigative work we did.
Interesting.
And, I mean, not directly, but we were in the same News Corp company.
Yes.
Until the shareholders over there didn't like that, right? Yes. So that model is, the investigative journalism model is very expensive because, you're spending all this money, quite good salary, I mean, not huge by financial standards or banking standards, but quite good salaries. Your kids are going to international schools, your housing is sort of subsidized, and you might not produce that many stories.
Yeah.
And when you do, what's the, it's good for the brand of the journal, but like...
And you don't know if it's going to be a, to use the word loosely, a hit.
Yeah.
Right? It's going to catch on and go
viral.
Does
it lead to subscriptions? It's hard. Yes. It's squishy, right? Like we actually lost a Malaysian tourism advertising campaign at the Journal because of the 1MDB coverage.
But you're saying that nowadays that journalism is biased, right? And you really can't really trust the mainstream media because there's always a hidden bias to it or hidden agenda.
Yeah, I think I would say my opinion is that journalism has always been biased, right? Okay. This idea that there's some kind of, you know, objective truth out there that we're all going to just report. I mean, what the difference is in the, you know, in the past, perhaps, there was a patriarchy of white males who sat on the editorial boards of these big newspapers, you know, the New York Times, the Journal, whatever, and they decided what people should think. And so, you know, that meant that that was the truth, right?
Yeah.
Now, there were also very good standards of trying to reach some kind of objectivity. You know, people would get two sources, they report deeply, and they would try to really find something that we could all agree was true. But the world's changed big time, right?
Oh, the world's changed. I mean, Tucker Carlson doing a 2-hour with Putin.
Or Elon Musk going down to the border or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, and Joe Rogan being a mainstream thing that people listen to, right?
I guess the bigger point might be that if you don't have an opinion, one will be given to you, and it can be given to you very easily, depending on what you read, because everything that you read has some kind of sociopolitical agenda, because unless you're a very discerning reader, and I put that in the minority of the minority of the minority of the population, people don't like just reading facts, right? There needs to be a story behind it. There needs to be a narrative behind it. And that's what sells. The facts themselves sell to very few people, I feel, especially if you look at this overlap between news and entertainment as being a fairly blurry line.
Yeah. So I think what's interesting nowadays is that because of the cost of production has dropped tremendously, right? So I remember when I was doing Asian Food Channel, just to get a TV show out on food, cost you thousands and thousands of dollars. Today, anybody who is, you know, interesting can just use a mobile phone and put it on TikTok. And I think similarly, you're seeing stories which previously, and I come back to Putin, right? If you were Putin, you either had Russian media who you could you sort of roll out as an infrastructure to tell your story. Nobody in the West would do it. But of course, if someone like Tucker Carlson was going to come over and just film it and then put it on a podcast, I just don't see that happening 10, 15, 20 years ago. You look at us, we took matters into our own hands and we started a podcast, and I'm sure, like, you know, hundreds of people are listening to it. But it doesn't matter because the cost of production has dropped significantly.
So the technical barrier to entry is really low. So everyone can come in. But what hasn't dropped is the skill set you need to actually do anything interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
So you referred to Tucker Carlson, right? He clearly has a skill of connecting with his audience. And to my mind, though, I mean, I was in a Singapore taxi where the taxi driver was listening to that interview you referred to with Putin.
He was listening to it.
Yeah.
And that is fascinating.
With the incredible, boring voice of the translator. And there is this idea, you can get really interesting stuff by giving people a long time to talk. Yes. That's why you get the Joe Rogan 2-3-hour interviews.
Yes.
I myself like to listen to stuff that's been curated for me by a professional who knows what is the news value.
What I liked about this fact was that I've never had the opportunity to just turn on my mobile phone and listen to somebody like Putin talk for 2 hours, right? And he'll give his perspective. We didn't start the war, all that kind of stuff.
You need to subscribe to Russian TV. I'm sure it's Putin all the time, actually.
No, you would get the five. You see, that's the thing. You would get the 5 to 7 minute soundbite because the format is that I'm talking to a certain audience and I just want to reinforce a message that's already there. Whereas when you have a 2-hour podcast, and this thing with Balaji, right? Balaji did a 7-hour podcast with Lex.
The former
Coinbase CTO. The ability to really go in and unpack, I think, is remarkable. And if you're an informed listener, or you're a person searching for, well, not necessarily the truth, but all the different perspectives, right? I think the world has changed significantly. The cost of production has driven it down to the point that you can actually just hear straight from the source, right? So, Tom, you're trying to do that with Brazen. And, how do you take advantage of this sort of format where you can have anybody and talk about that?
And perhaps maybe to put another perspective on that, do you still consider yourself a journalist, or are you in the entertainment business now?
It's both. We're doing both for sure. We're still journalists. I mean, we've Politico just interviewed my partner Bradley, my co-founder of Brazen, Bradley Hope, for a story that we broke in our newsletter called Whale Hunting. So that's a barrier to entry thing. So
yeah,
we've broken many stories there. We broke a story about Kushner leaving the White House and getting a $2 billion investment from the Middle East, you know, and then the New York Times had to pick that up. And so that's an example of what you're saying, where it's flatter. Mm. But we're only breaking those stories because I spent 20 years at the Wall Street Journal. So it would be very hard, I think, to come and start breaking news like that from nowhere.
Oh, for sure, right? The signal noise ratio is very high, right? I mean, a lot of people go like, oh, I want to start out a podcast, right? And then you don't realize that actually you need to either have the technique or the gravitas or that audience that's going to look for it.
Yeah.
And you don't have to have millions of audience, right? You can have a hardcore dedicated thousands of audience and it's still meaningful to do it. Right?
I mean, there's a kid at my kids go to school here in Singapore and there's a kid there who's trying out for the varsity basketball team and he's created a massive audience for himself, like just by having really well curated videos.
It
doesn't all have to be hard news. And you're saying, obviously Lex Friedman has a huge audience by having very
it's very vertical
guests.
Though, you know what I'm saying? It's huge in the sort of actual numbers, but it's not like hundreds of millions.
Well Lex Friedman would have a huge audience, no?
Okay, so I'm trying to say it's like Fox News and CNN has a huge audience, right? So Lex has a very big audience for sure, but it's an audience of people who want to listen to 3 hours of very intense conversation with very specific human beings. And I think because of the cost of production has come down, you can afford to, as a business model, do that full time, you know, commit yourself to that craft and actually make it work, you know?
But I think it's the size of the audience that matters as well.
It's what
it
you
could
do
also
with
be,
it.
Well, you keep telling yourself that yet. It's also, I mean, it depends on what is the loyalty of that fan base, right? So I don't know if you're familiar with Kevin Kelly's work, where he said that all you need is 1,000 loyal fans paying a certain amount a month, and you can build a sustainable business doing that, right? So who are the people that will come to you that want to read your work? And expanding that from 10 to 100 to 1,000 is sometimes all you really need.
Do you have a specialist website with 1,000 friends paying you very specific large amounts of money for exclusive content.
Don't you have that too? His yenness?
No. Mine is all for free.
the world is getting balkanized, right?
Yes.
And there's such thing as a low quality audience or a high quality audience, right? Yep. If you have like you said, 1,000 very high quality, at Brazen, you know, we have 10,000 subscribers to our newsletter, and they're very high quality people. You know, Mark Andreessen is like one of the subscribers. So, you know, it's free. Don't make any money out of him, but not yet. But that's a useful thing we're trying to build at Brazen. So people come to us because they want a certain kind of content. And then one of our models for in Hollywood, because obviously we're now doing stories that we think have huge adaptation potential for TV and film, is A24, right? Who have also very loyal. You know, everyone wants their merch, their films.
Oh, I met the head of international A24 at your party, the rain party, you know, and you can see how these folks are just dying to find great stories.
Yeah, and you know, their movies are not the Marvel movies.
They're
great movies.
So regale us with some interesting projects that you're currently working on.
Well, so we set up this company 3 years ago, Bradley and I. We're based in Singapore and London, and we have, you know, one of these companies that has people all over the world, like social media managers in Berlin, operations managers in New York. So we're all over the place.
What are the cool stories?
So we've done about 15 podcasts in the last 3 years. And we started, our first podcast was Fat Leonard, which is about this fat guy. I mean, he was called Fat Leonard by other people. We didn't make up that nickname. And he was a 300-pound Navy contractor. You know, he's based here in Singapore, actually. He lived on Nassim Road. For those of you who don't know Singapore,
That's the best road.
The best road, one of the best roads. $40 million house up there. Ferraris, nice. Lamborghinis at the front. And his only business that he'd ever done was with the U.S. Navy. He was like a contractor. So the ships would come into port. He'd take out the latrines, bring on the fresh water, fuel, all of that stuff. And then after September the 11th, he would protect the ships as well when they were worried about Jamaat Islamiyah and all those Al-Qaeda affiliates.
I listened to that podcast. He had his own navy. He had his own warship. Yeah, he had his own warship.
It was a British warship that the Singaporean Navy had used for a while as a training ship, and then he bought it for his own warship.
And then I also listened to a podcast that Tom had called The Professor, which is about the art world and how people would miraculously find amazing pieces of art, but actually behind the scenes, they had already pre-negotiated the price, and you know, all these rewards were going back to the mafia and all that kind of stuff.
Well, it gets back to truth is stranger than fiction. So the Fat Leonard podcast is about a guy who made all this money by overcharging the Navy. And in return, what he did was he would organize orgies for Navy admirals, including here in the Singapore hotels. And then he would record them and then have sexual compromat that he would hold. And so there was admiral. And so the whole top tier of the US Navy, when the scandal finally broke, had to be cleaned out. And they shoved it under the rug. None of these admirals went to jail. There was an admiral who was in line to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top military position in the U.S., who had been involved in one of these parties.
And was struck off.
They were all struck off quietly, retired. There's now a female Navy admiral in charge of the U.S. Navy. The top admiral is now a female for the first time in U.S. history. All of this came after this. Leonard himself had been jailed and was so angry that the admirals were getting off. He arranged for us to send a microphone to him in detention, and we recorded 20 hours of so this is the truth is stranger than fiction. And then he went on the run to Venezuela. He cut his ankle. He was in home arrest, not jail, because he's sick, has cancer. Cut his ankle monitor off and
this
escaped.
Was after he was in house arrest in San Diego.
After he did the podcast.
So yeah. Because the last time I remember you telling me this was he was still in house arrest. Now he's in Venezuela.
Yeah, No. So then he went on the run to Venezuela,
yeah,
where we then reported in our newsletter that he was on the run there because we found out before the authorities.
Okay.
He was then arrested while trying to escape to Russia and sent back to the U.S. recently, a few weeks ago, to face his sentencing. So on the one hand,
the Americans don't like you because you exposed something, but on the other hand, they go like, yeah, but Tom, thank you very much for getting the guy.
No, they didn't want him back because they'd already let off all the admirals in this case. And they jailed some lower guys, lower level officers. Yeah. One admiral got jailed, the first ever admiral to get jailed. But mostly the guys who went to jail in this case were lower level people.
Yeah,
and you know the story. We're turning this into a feature film at the moment with the.
It's coming out.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow. Who's starring? Well, we're working. Leonard.
Yeah. Well, we haven't. We're at the script stage right now.
And so you have, the professor, which I previously mentioned. Tell us how that's coming along.
So that's a story about a British art dealer, British Hungarian art dealer, who's arrested in London for dealing with the Italian mafia.
Yeah.
Now the dirty secret of the arts world is a lot of stuff stolen, right? I mean, we had another podcast about a guy who colluded with the Khmer Rouge to steal all the Cambodian art, called Dynamite Doug. The professor's about this guy who colludes
Dynamite
with the...
I love these names.
Well, he used dynamite to blow dynamite up the statue so he could then steal.
Yeah, of course. That's how he got the nickname, Dynamite Doug.
But the professor is about this this art dealer who's called the professor because he's an absolute expert in his field, which is coins from the Roman era. And he's arrested for dealing with the mafia. But then the Italian anti-mafia police give him a deal. They say, if you can help find this $100 million Caravaggio painting that was stolen by the mafia in the 60s, we'll let you off your charges. And so our reporter followed him deep into the mafia. It's kind of about art, but it's really a great way to tell a mafia story.
That is fascinating.
From a modern perspective. And it turns out this painting is still with the mafia, but you have to listen.
I was listening to the first episode of the podcast. I think what's very interesting is the way you actually tell the story, which includes the fact that if you were a farmer in Sicily finding antiquities, you're not quite the right person to fence it in in New York. And so the mafia was kind of like seen as a local, almost like a local hero, because they would get cash to a Sicilian farmer and the Sicilian farmer would have a livelihood. Mm. And it was just really the only reason why it's maybe not cool is because it's deemed as illegal. But you know, these mafia folks were providing real trading, B2B trading services to Sicilian populations.
And then, you know, that podcast, which is a true story with original audio of the dealer, becomes the basis for the scripted adaptation, the TV show or the film. So almost nothing gets made in Hollywood these days without an underlying piece of intellectual property.
Are you seeing any interest for Southeast Asian stories? I know that from your website, there's a couple of stories that you're working on in that area.
Yeah,
too.
Well, I mean, like I said, Fat Leonard, we're working with SK Global, who are our partners.
Dynamite Doug.
Well, no, this is for Fat Leonard. And yeah. SK Global are the guys who behind the producers behind Crazy Rich Asians. So we're working on turning that into a feature film at the moment. And that's we're very excited about that because it's based in Southeast Asia, but it obviously it involves the US Navy. So it's an international story. So that's the trick. If you're going to do these international stories, you've got to find ones that are going to sell.
Across audiences.
Yeah, you can't, you know, HBO for a while had HBO Asia and they tried to do stories that were very Asian.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
and it just doesn't work out because it's hard to justify the budgets for that kind of thing.
Yes.
But I think, you know, you can do stories that are global. It's tricky, though. You have to thread the needle and it has to be, you know, it has to have elements. I mean, I don't know if any of you have seen The Expatriates, which is a Nicole Kidman show that's on Amazon now. So
it's set
in Hong Kong,
based
on the book. And it's obviously like set in Hong Kong,
yes.
but it has a lot of like Western characters.
Yeah.
So crucial. We're in the room. You're in Los Angeles. You're in front of a movie production studio and your agent goes, oh my God, you know, this is a great story. Like, how do they actually pitch Fat Leonard to, say, the studios, right?
The key is to make it seem like something that either if it's a TV show, it's going to be able to generate multiple seasons.
Oh, okay.
So the limited series now in Hollywood are totally dead. Like I don't know, for example, The Expatriates, right? Six episodes and it's done.
Yeah. Yeah.
No one's ordering those to series anymore because...
But how are you going to do three seasons of Fat Leonard?
So Fat Leonard will be a feature. We actually did think of it as a TV show for a while and now we're pivoting to features because there's those kind of... Low budget features, you know, in the $30 million range are much more popular
now.
Is it
a feature, a single episode or a series?
A feature means a film.
A film, okay.
Yeah, so it's basically a 90-minute to 2-hour film, okay. and it's contained.
Yes.
Sometimes it'll get a theatrical release, sometimes
these days it won't. But $30 million is very cost-effective for a film.
The big Marvel movies are done for 100, 200. I think that film Argyle that just came out in the box office was $200 million.
My God!
And it's very hard. I think they're going to lose tons of money on that film.
Yes.
It's very hard to make.
I heard it wasn't doing well.
Yeah, that film hasn't done well. Yeah, it's got bad reviews in it, and then you spend so much money on it. Films now have these limited release windows, and then obviously they come onto the streaming services later, right? So that's the model. But yeah, so you have to find something that either it's going to be. TV is going back to the soapy, you know, Yellowstone characters. Like, you know, when we were growing up watching Dallas and Dynasty.
Yeah,
and
the multi-seasonal things. Yeah.
Which people think is ironic because it's on cable TV. Yeah. It's on streaming TV, but it's like the old cable TV.
Oh, I love that series, Yellowstone. Yeah. It was. I watched very little TV, but that was recommended strongly by a number of people. Mm. And I enjoyed that show a lot. I think what surprises me is how viewership habits are changing. And I wonder how that manifests itself across, you know, the spectrum of media. For example, we hear this common narrative that everyone's switching to short form content, BuzzFeed, TikTok, quick videos. No one has the patience to watch anything long. But at the same time, people would be completely willing to sit in front of something like Netflix for an entire weekend and just go on a binge.
I think the key is, you know, and this is what we did with Billion Dollar Whale with a book. Our editor at the publishing house was like, well, this book is 400 pages and you've got 24 chapters. Mm. Why don't you make it the same number of pages, but make it 50 chapters and make the chapters short?
Okay.
Like a James Patterson novel, like an airport novel.
Yes.
And that's the same thing with what you're talking about, right? Yellowstone episodes are what? They're not that long, right? They're probably 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Lots of episodes are getting shorter, actually.
Yes.
And then, you know, you have a lot of them. So you spoon feed, you know, you drip.
Yeah,
you drip
there's two windows now, right? There's the extremely short, and then it's like I feel like the extremely long,
like a Lex Friedman.
Yeah, you know, because the middle is sort of 24 minute. Like I used to Asian Food Channel, 24 minute, you know, plus 6 minutes of interstitials, and then you get 30 minutes. And what I like about it now is that
barbell strategy of content.
You know, if you want to be distracted from your work, there's a format for you, right?
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting is, you know, 2 hour formats. With people unpacking, you know, LDL cholesterol or how I think I should run a country or, you know, why there should be a network state. And that's, again, you know, the diversity. So media's not dead.
No, but I still don't understand the people who can sit down for 3 hour podcasts. I don't get I've tried that. No, I've tried that myself.
I can't.
No, the way to do it is you do it 1.5x. Or 2x.
I guess I've spent my career, you know, until this point thinking of how do you distill a lot of reporting and a lot of investigative work into a narrative. I think we got a review of one of our podcasts once where the reviewer in The Guardian in the UK called it brusque storytelling. And that's probably how
brusque. I mean, brusque. As in too tight.
I personally like Storytelling that is not done in a meandering way.
It should be fast-paced and going,
oh no, this is why, like, for a large majority of these podcasts, unfortunately, you have to put it at 1.5x, right?
Hey guys.
Yeah, hey guys, welcome.
I told my kids, if you do a podcast, don't
start with hey guys
and then just keep talking nonsense. Yeah, you've got to make a point,
and you got to get the insights in, and you can't waste your viewers thinking. But, like, you know, I keep on coming back to, you know, Lex and the density of his work, right? Because he interviews people who literally have so many ideas. You know, 7 hours of Balaji sounds like a crazy amount of time, but it's exhausting.
This is Balaji Srinivasan?
Yeah, who lives in Singapore.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and someone asked me, I said...
Setting up his government's new government for the world?
Yeah, network state, yeah. That's yeah. Right. He's going to declare it in the Tampanese, you know. no, but it's incredible that you can have... If you have a person who can keep at that pace... Someone will put a 4-hour podcast there, and it's you know, because the cost of technology is coming
down. It's also a function of the fact that Lex can do it.
Yeah.
If this was a random podcast with a 7-hour episode with Balaji, no one would listen to that.
Yeah,
but Lex, you assume a certain quality and reason for that episode and the length of that episode, which is why you'd be more willing to listen to it, even if you scrub it. I think there's also perhaps there's a difference between when you want to compress something that's more fact-driven and when you want to listen or read a story. You know, I think nonfiction's pretty interesting in the sense that a lot of nonfiction books can be summarized into a few pages, but no one can sell a few pages at a bookstore for $29.90 or anything like that. So you feel like you've got to add the wrappers and the story and the narrative and all of those things around it.
Yeah. How many times have you bought a nonfiction book and thought this is a magazine article that we extended to a book?
Oh, that's it. And so you've got all of these apps like Blinkist and stuff like that. And now people use ChatGPT and all of those tools to just quickly summarize and distill the few key takeaways.
It reminds me of what Sam Bankman-Fried famously said, like, why would I read a book when it could be distilled into 6 bullet points, whatever
there
it was.
There we go.
Not that I should be quoting Sam Bankman for anything.
But for a story, right, when you want to be entertained, I think, and if you want to read it, you don't want to, you're not looking for the quick one-page summary bullet point, right? If you're telling the story about what happened, for example, in Billion Dollar Whale or The Professor or any of these other formats, you've got to go through the art of storytelling as well. How do you weave a narrative? How do you engage the reader's attention? How do you captivate?
But I still think that there's a lot of like downtime in badly constructed storytelling, right?
Yes.
Like, I get what you're saying, that there's room for some eddies to go into an eddy for a while and get out of the rapid. But you know, I'm watching at the moment For All Mankind on Apple TV about
You don't like it?
I'm going to say it's good.
Do you like the pacing on that?
It's slow, but I think it cuts out any sort of fat. I mean, it's more a character-driven show than a sci-fi show, actually.
Yeah, okay.
But the other one I really have loved recently is Criminal Record, the British show, which is also on Apple TV. That's just fantastic. And very sort of taut, you know, you're not wasting too much time. I guess it's personal taste.
But I think what is not in debate over here is that journalism serves a very important function in society. And it's important to have a free and open market insofar as all of this information is concerned, whether it's good or bad.
Sunlight is the best disinfectant, fellas.
Yeah. No, and that's why the podcast is here.
And on that note, thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. Yeah.